Folks, I want to welcome you all to On the Edge with K.A. Owens. I'm K.A. Owens, and we are broadcasting from the top of the Habern Building in Louisville, Kentucky. This is 106.5 FM Forward Radio, and you can go to forwardradio.org to find out a little bit more about our station. You're live streaming now, and that means you can listen to us anywhere in the city, anywhere in the state, anywhere in the country, anywhere in the world. So we are live streaming now, so it means you can get a clear signal on your smartphone or other device. So again, I'm K.A. Owens. This is On the Edge with K.A. Owens, and we've got a great guest for you today. We've got Will Severson. Did I pronounce your last name correctly?
It's no worries. It's Severson with the long E.
Severson. All right, Will Severson. Okay. So, folks, Will Severson is a film student at the University of Louisville. I met him, took COM 339, outstanding class out there at the university. Have so many opportunities for students out there. So, Will, in your opinion, what are the high points of the cinema world today? As we speak, anything interesting going on that makes the cinema world more interesting than it might ordinarily be?
Absolutely, yeah. I think that one of the core elements that makes cinema more like interesting nowadays is that there's become like a big conversation between the nature of like a size of one story versus the weight of it. Like for anyone that you know loves the Marvel Cinematic Universe, for example. I've seen a lot of comparisons between Ant-Man and the Wasp and its main villain, Kang the Conqueror, played by Jonathan Majors, and then comparing that with the Guardians of the Galaxy main villain, the High Evolutionary, and saying how even though Kang is this character who can, like, destroy worlds and, you know, make, you know, and, like, do all this stuff, he was seen as less intimidating and less, you know, memorable than this one guy who had been operating in the shadows for years and years.
So, yes. Now, I very much enjoy the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I love it. I mean, I was raised on the comic books before the technology enabled Marvel and its partners to really make some fascinating movies with strong stories behind it, with a series of directors. But now some people complain that there's too much MCU. So as from a business point of view, is the MCU keeping the movie business alive? Or some people think that, the MCU and Tom Cruise are actually keeping Hollywood alive. So as far as income, as far as money.
Yeah, I think there is a very strong argument that we made there because, I mean, yes, there have been certain bombs, like with Ant-Man and the Wasp, for example, or Eternals, but when a Marvel movie succeeds, it brings in far more revenue than you would get from a standard niche independent A24 film, for example. Like, Everything Everywhere All at Once made $25 million, but that's on a budget of, like, around maybe $5 million. But that's pretty small potatoes when you compare that to something like this. Like, for example, the MCU's last Spider-Man film that made over $1 billion on, like a $250 million budget or whatever insane number that they have to do to make Tom Holland look like he's, you know, in a CGI costume. And I think that with Tom Cruise, he's one of the last true, like, action stars. Like, if you go back to the 80s and 90s, you had Schwarzenegger, you had, you know, Linda Hamilton, you had Sigourney Weaver. But nowadays, it's like a lot of the big, quote-unquote, celebrities, I argue, are less so celebrities because their face sells, and more because of their acting. So in a way, I think it's kind of a double-edged sword, because on one hand, you have, like, people like Paul Dano from, you know, The Fablemans or The Batman that are given the proper opportunity to act without having to worry about, oh, I recognize him, and you can just simply the part. Tom Cruise is truly kind of part of that dying breed of just, like, you see Tom Cruise in a movie, you go to see it. Like, I think part of that is because of the rise in Marvel movies, and, well, it's just oversaturation in media with, you know, popular IPs like superheroes, like book adaptations, getting more of a front central baseline than they used to. And I think that those definitely keep that aspect of Hollywood alive because of the fact that it's like, because of the death of the, what I like to call the mid-budget movie, those that are like, cause nowadays you either have something like real obscure and niche, like an A24 film that has, you know, a penny, that has a budget of like, you know, pennies compared to others that are like, could, you know, fund an entire country. And I think that a lot of those mid-budget movies are what made the golden age of Hollywood so successful. I mean, it's the reason why when Cleopatra bombed back, you know, in this, you know, back in the 70s, the 1980s, you saw a bigger increase in those kind of like mid-budget stars, and you got people who otherwise wouldn't have got as much attention. So I think that Tom Cruise is very much not only part of that dying breed, but I think it's a byproduct that if you aren't like immediately recognizable, then you have to put on a thing of spandex, or you really have to stretch your range, as opposed to like back then to where there was more options because there was more ways to make a movie within the mainstream light.
So, well, I give Tom Cruise credit because I really think he's a good actor because he brings off the action movies in spite of being physically small. So that is acting. You know, he makes people believe that that a man who's well-trained and competent can bring a set of techniques to the table to be effective in the action movies. And also, he seems to enjoy, even though he's approaching middle age, he seems to enjoy doing a lot of things himself, riding motorcycles and flying airplanes and all of these things. So, and people know that he does that, so it adds a little something to the whole thing that he's bringing to the table. So that all kind of it all kinds of works, and I do think that you kind of need Tom Cruise in the MCU because going to the movies, physically getting, you know where you shave, take a shower, put on clean clothes, get in your car or walk or ride the bus to a movie theater for an experience, it's something different, and you need something to draw people to that that's not TV-ish. And so for me, even today, as many movies as I've seen, it's still an experience for me to go to the theater. And the shared experience, even if people exchange a few words. I never will forget, this is slightly before the pandemic, I'm thinking, they did a documentary on Amy Winehouse. Now, Amy Winehouse, for those who don't know, was a British singer who sort of hit big and then died at 27 years old. She had a lot of issues with the alcohol and so on and so forth, but she was a tremendous talent. And she had her own look and style. So I went to see it during a matinee at Baxter Avenue, and I just knew this was going to happen. There were a couple girls there who were dressed like Amy Winehouse, right? So Amy Winehouse meant so much to them that they put on her look for a matinee. So it's going to a movie is just a different experience than watching TV. And so you need something to keep the movie theaters alive. In other words, for me, you need a Tom Cruise or the MCU to keep Baxter Avenue alive so they can run an Amy Winehouse documentary, even if it's only there for 2 or 3 weeks. You know, an Amy Winehouse documentary is not going to run as long as, Infinity Wars.
See, and if I could add to that, I think that, like, in terms of the MCU, part of what made that it's the same reason why something like the new Mario movie, for example, is doing so well, you know, because, like, even ignoring the star-studded cast, like, everyone and their mother knows who Mario is, just like everyone and their mother knows who Spider-Man is. So it's just like, when you already have that built in, and it's the reason why you see so many studios trying to pump out sequel after sequel, remake after remake, because they know it's a winning formula. And
so name that movie, the Argo. Did you say Argo or Margo? What did you call it? The movie that you said before.
Movie I said before. Like you mean?
Right. Well, you mentioned that a movie that everybody knew, but I couldn't understand the title as you said it.
Oh, yeah. The new Mario movie.
Mario. Yes. M-A-R-I-O. So you're talking about the animated movie.
Yes, I am.
Yes. Yes. Big fan base for those movies. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, same thing. That's the thing I've noticed that despite the fact that they're so different, that's the intrinsic link I'm noticing that with a lot of, like, that with the figures like the Tom Cruises and the Keanu Reeves of the industry have in common with a lot of these big blockbusters is that they're conditioned to think of a very specific element. I mean, Tom Cruise, just like Keanu Reeves, they were in the 90s. You know, like, you know, you knew him from The Matrix or the original Mission Impossible. You may have known Tom Cruise from something like A Few Good Men. So it's like you already have those big names that were caked into that nostalgia.
Yes, yes, yes. And so, and I do agree with Steven Spielberg. I don't think that streaming productions should be included in the Academy Award categories because I don't think they're movies. If you're not going to the theater, you know, they're not movies. And I just don't think that the streaming I don't think streaming is accessible in the sense that because of the way what I call TV, you know, even if you use a streaming service or on your other device, I mean, you have smart TVs now where you can run the stuff from the internet. And to me, it's not the same, and everybody doesn't know them. I mean, so you have stars getting paid good, really good money to make these streaming productions, but I just don't think everybody sees them. Or a lot of people see them, and Quentin Tarantino has commented on that. He said that who are these people? What are these movies? Who has seen them on this? You know, so you can comment on what Quentin said because that might be a tack for this conversation to take. What your opinion is on Quentin Tarantino, anyway?
Well, I think that it's interesting you bring up the whole streaming versus theaters argument because. Even though I've seen a lot of people put it in that strict dichotomy that streaming, either has to be streaming or cinema, I actually think I disagree with Tarantino that it actually weakens a movie impact. I think the opposite is true, that streaming is more like an extension of cinema rather than a limitation to it, because I think it's especially if a movie comes out, like, I understand the counter argument when you look at films like, I know a recent example of a streaming movie that definitely hurt theaters was, what was it? It was the Glass Onion, Knives Out story. You know, basically it was made by Rian Johnson, for those who are unaware. And it's like a murder sequel to the popular murder mystery from 2019. So I can see that counter argument with, like, okay, well, streaming takes away that, you know, that audience that would otherwise see it at theater, that hurts that box office. But I think it can more often be used to enhance something people already love. I mean, going back to Marvel for a second, if you love the MCU and you go on Disney Plus, say there's a movie that isn't in theaters anymore, and you have it where you wanted to, you know, rewatch it, but you didn't want to, say, like, buy the thing because you know how there are certain, like, movies that people may just want to see for the first time because they miss it in theaters, or they haven't seen it in a while, but they don't really, like, own it yet. I think that streaming can be a good way to entice people to give a movie a chance that they wouldn't have otherwise because of how expensive ticket prices are. Once is the big thing that a lot of these directors I don't feel like really bring up, and that going to a movie nowadays, especially in our current, you know, economic market, is far more of a financial burden than it used to be. I mean, because it's like, it's the reason why it's important to look at movies that are adjusted for inflation, for example. But I think that streaming can actively help movies that otherwise wouldn't have gotten exposure. Like, do you remember that one movie in 2021, The Suicide Squad, the one directed by James Gunn?
Like Suicide Squad 2 you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah.
See, that one, because of the pandemic, you know, the big elephant in the room, that movie did terrible in theaters. And it was, like, for me, so frustrating because I was thinking, like, oh, my gosh, this is such a really emotionally involving storyline that goes out its way to give the DCEU some real tangible stakes and memorable characters. I mean, I still tear up at the climax of that film. But many people didn't see it because they were, you know, scared to go to theaters. So what would have otherwise been really successful in the theater market was hindered by the pandemic. But then you look at it, when it went to streaming, it became one of HBO's best performing, or sorry, excuse me, Max now. It used to be HBO Max, now it's Max. But now it's like, with HBO Max, current Max, it's gotten a whole new opportunity to share that experience with new people. And I think the bigger issue isn't with streaming versus, and while I definitely respect your opinion with the whole, you know, that cinema is definitely, you know, experience within itself, that's why I'm going to see Oppenheimer in theaters before I see it on DVD, is that that lack of physical media is the real threat here that I think a lot of people don't realize, because we're so caught up in, well, streaming, because when you stream a movie, you don't own it. In the same way that when you go to a theater, you don't own that premiere. You're just experiencing it for the first time. It's, they're both two sides of the same coin in that you're just going to experience something, but it's not really yours. You're just seeing it from another point of view. That's why I think that, you know, promoting things like DVDs or digital copies or Blu-rays becoming less and less commonplace now and relying solely on streaming versus cinema hinders the audience's ability to really enjoy these stories for years to come, which I think is far more damaging than just whether or not streaming movies should be promoted. I think it's less that they shouldn't be promoted and more that they should be, promoted with the DVD Blu-ray release, because then it gives audiences that second chance that they wouldn't really get to see. You know what I mean?
Oh, sure, absolutely. So, what did I see? I saw the latest animated Spider-Man, and yeah. And so I listened to some of the audience commentary. That is, there were some young people sitting across from me, they're like, I paid money for this because it didn't have the ending, like a clear wrap up as far as the ending. I don't want to be a spoiler, but Miles Morales was still in jeopardy. That sort of thing. So I enjoy listening to what people say, and then at the movies, particularly with certain movies, certain people will sit all the way through the credits to see if there's going to be something extra to lead into the next movie. And so I'm always curious to see who's going to sit all the way through the credits for that.
I'm definitely that guy.
So there's something to be said. And of course, at Baxter, they've got like the wine thing where, where you can get wine to go along with the movie. That's interesting. I wasn't raised with that, but that's fascinating to me. And they've got the private screening booth over at Baxter too. So I don't know how much that cost. I never have checked that out. To Quentin Tarantino, he's talking about retiring from the movies. He seldom, misses a step. I do think Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, he did disrespect Bruce Lee. I think he was told that at the time. I will say this to anybody, I think that he should apologize to the family of Bruce Lee and send a letter of apology to the Chinese embassy. He really did a misstep there. And it's because he's not a fighter who doesn't understand fighting. He doesn't understand the history of martial arts. And he doesn't even know what Bruce Lee did. He doesn't really get it. That is, Bruce Lee actually created a worldwide, well, he built on top of what was already there as far as the Hong Kong martial arts movies, right? What some people call the Chop Saki flicks. And he built on top of that, but he turned that into something that could sell all over the world. And there were some dynamics there. The third world people in the third world, they love seeing sort of an Asiatic male, a small framed Asiatic male who could take on all comers, right? No matter how big. So they love that and representing Asian culture. Also, he single-handedly changed the image of the Asiatic male, particularly in Hollywood, which was also the kind of small, you know, weak, without masculinity. So he changed the image of the Asiatic male by himself.
If I could interject there for a second. I think that I've definitely seen those clips of Bruce Lee. It's interesting what Bruce Lee really had to deal with, especially for his last film. For those unaware, he for his final film, they actually had to use stunt doubles to replicate certain scenes. It was like the first time we really saw like a quote unquote like deep fake in the industry. So even his final film, you know, with him not being in certain parts of it because of his unfortunate demise, you know, rest in peace, did fundamentally change the way that Hollywood could make a movie. Because usually it's like when the actor dies, before that point, it's kind of like, oh, shoot, they're dead. Well, now we have to completely change the story. But this was the first time that we really got to see a character continue to live on with the actor. Because, you know, he signed up for a full film, so they shot around it. But even then, Hollywood still didn't really know how to appropriately handle it. Because during those, like, casket scenes, during that movie, they actually used real images of Bruce Lee, his body in the casket without his permission, without his family's permission, they just shot it. And it's just yet another example of Hollywood, you know, blatantly disrespecting, you know, the actor without realizing the full context of their impact. And I think it's rather telling that it's like Quentin Tarantino for such a, you know, because he is, you know, a director who's made a lot of great films. But I think it's sometimes that Tarantino's so caught up in his worldview and his, like, characters and settings that for Tarantino it makes sense to him. But sometimes he doesn't realize the social impact of the way he portrays certain real life people. Like, when you make a fictional character, you know, larger than life and cocky, that's one thing. But when you make Bruce Lee cocky, like, Bruce Lee was blunt. He was a very blunt man. You know, he very much was a say it like it is, you know, forward person. There was no doublespeak or subtext in his words. That's just not the kind of man he was. But the fact that it's like you see him going around parading as like my fist or lethal weapons, it's like he would be blunt if he genuinely didn't think he could do something. I remember the infamous Mike Tyson versus Bruce Lee thing where Bruce Lee just shut that down. He was just like, have you seen my little hands? I'm not beating Mike Tyson. So there was that element of humility that I think would be fine for like a fictional character to remove. But when you put that on a real person, it can become a lot more disingenuous. And, you know, obviously Tarantino, I don't think he's going to apologize, even though I absolutely agree with you that he should. Just because Tarantino is a man who is very committed to his mindset, and that if he thinks he did something well, in his mind, he did it well. And I think that even though there are plenty of things to admire about Tarantino, I think sometimes he can, in situations like that, or when he does those foot shots with Margot Robbie's character, I'm sorry, I can't quite remember who. In Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, sometimes he can think so much of like, okay, well, I know the story I want to tell, but he may forget that these are real people with actual families and impacts, and especially when what happened with the...
Because Margot Robbie's friend was playing a real life... she was playing the actress who was killed by the Manson family, who's and her name is not coming to me, the real life actress who was sort of an up and coming it girl in Hollywood. So we talked about Bruce Lee, and you were talking about Bruce Lee and Muhammad Ali, because Mike Tyson wasn't around when Bruce Lee
No, that's a oopsie moment for me. No, you got me
right, but that's okay, because the whole thing about Bruce and the martial arts, Bruce wasn't just a martial arts actor. Bruce Lee was born in the United States, raised in Hong Kong, and then as a young man came to the United States to see what he could do with Hollywood. He'd been acting in Hong Kong, and then he went as far as Hollywood would let him go, and Hollywood just blocked him, so he went back to Hong Kong and was able to create something there that would sell all over the world. And then, of course, with Enter the Dragon, he created, you know, the sort of the seminal martial arts film it was Hollywood in pluses with it was every it was Hollywood plus sort of the honk the stylistic things from the Hong Kong martial arts scene. So, and it sold all over the world. It had, of course, James Gavin, or is it James Gavin or John Gavin, and Jim Kelly, who played Williams. Folks, you must know this. Jim Kelly from Kentucky. Look it up. Jim Kelly is from Kentucky. He's dead now. He played Williams in Enter the Dragon. Jim Kelly, you know, went out to the West. Well, first of all, not only is Jim Kelly from Kentucky, he played football at the University of Louisville. So the same campus, Will, that you and I walked around, Jim Kelly walked around that same campus before he went to Hollywood. So,
wow.
And so did martial arts, and then was lucky enough, and, you know, he'll kind of live forever because he was in Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee. So, folks, you can look up Jim Kelly on YouTube, and it's interesting. Jim Kelly was saying that, like a lot of people weren't studying traditional martial arts now because everything was MMA. But going back to Bruce Lee, what Bruce Lee did, he, besides being a martial arts actor, he made martial arts real, because a lot of the martial arts, when he was coming along, they weren't doing contact sparring in school. So the way he taught, there was a lot of contact sparring to see what worked and what didn't work. So he incorporated things from fencing and boxing and applied it. So there was all kind of conflict between Bruce and traditional martial artists. But Bruce made sure that martial arts would work and be effective. So the idea of Quentin Tarantino portraying Bruce as someone who didn't know how to make martial arts work is absurd. And also, because it was Bruce is the one that makes sure that they worked. And also, but anyway, folks, we're coming toward the end. We're going to have to bring Will back. Will, pronounce your last name for me correctly.
It's Severson.
Severson. Will Severson. Will, thank you so much, and we will definitely bring you back. On the Edge with K.A. Owens, folks.